Hello, I'm Hannah Kiffertman.
I'm Catherine Orchard.
And I'm Hannah van der Vesthuizen.
And we are
the Fuckboy Podcast.
Welcome to, what episode are we on?
Oh, the fourth episode.
May the fourth be with you.
That's actually my dad's birthday, and I am so tired of that joke. I don't think it's ever not been made.
Does your dad always make it?
No, but people all of his friends, it's like a very dad-like joke,
yeah.
Isn't it?
So
it's
Star Wars.
My dad?
Yeah.
Oh, God, no. Couldn't be further away from Star Wars.
It is Star Wars, right?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
My dad is much more of a James Bond man.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, right.
He loves James Bond.
Mine's exactly the same.
Yeah.
My dad's like a Jason Bourne, Bond, Mission Impossible, obsessed with Tom Cruise. Tom Cruise is his one true love.
Oh, really?
Theory, dads are either Star Wars, Marvel,
ooh,
or James Bond. No, what's your dad?
My dad is like...
Softball Central.
No, my dad is like old black and white talkies.
Oh, my dad's not that cool.
See, that probably actually makes him quite cool.
He watches like Softboy. A rogue channel that's like 38 on preview or whatever. And it is just back-to-back black and white movies.
Wow.
I think it's called like the history... Softboy. Something, yeah.
Yeah. Love that.
No, he's just really old.
He's actually just ancient.
My dad is 80.
So youthful for 80.
Yeah, your dad's pretty old too.
My dad's
right?
pretty old. Yeah. Some old dads up in here.
Yeah. Paul's the youthful one.
Yeah, Paul is youthful, isn't he?
How old is he?
Paul is 55.
Oh my God, he's a spring chicken.
He's younger than my mother.
Love that for her.
Ooh.
My ex-boyfriend's grandma... Her husband was 25 years younger than her.
Wow.
And I remember going to the house and being like, hello.
Wait, how much? 25?
25 years younger.
Sorry, you said that and I completely disappeared because it made me think about Sarah Paulson.
And her wife.
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that until today.
Did you not?
No, I was doing some like gay Googling.
Yeah.
And
it is Pride
it
Month
came up.
When
it,
we're
exactly.
Recording
this. We're recording this in Pride Month. So I was like, give me
what's
all the gay
again?
Couples. Something fucking great.
Oh,
like Halliday or...
She's
like... I can't remember.
It's Holland Taylor.
Holland I knew it was Taylor. Hate.
Which is also like shocking that we... Because she's a great actress.
But I don't think I've ever seen her in anything.
She's in Legally Blonde.
Oh, yes, of course.
Right. She was in Two and a Half Men as the mum.
Yes.
That's the thing that was like... Now, my dad loved Two and a Half Men. He used
I
to
can
watch
see that.
It. Yeah, like what people had with friends, my dad had with Two and a Half Men.
I don't know what Two and a Half Men is. Am I?
It's the
Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, Charlie Sheen.
Oh, yeah. I don't know any of that.
I didn't ever watch it, but I knew about it because I think when we were young.
Oh, I did.
Charlie Sheen was like.
He had
Hannibal,
a bit of a breakdown, I think, didn't he?
Oh, I didn't know that. I knew that he wasn't on the show anymore. And maybe Ashton Kutcher.
And Ashton Kutcher came in because the character that he plays is a total fuckboy. So obviously, Ashton Kutcher had to come in and play him.
Yeah, because
who's the half?
Fuckboy.
So Charlie's brother has a son who's half
the half.
He's a child. But by the end, he's like a full-on adult.
Because
the series ran four... I can tell you now, 12 years.
Holy shit.
Yeah,
that just totally passed me by.
Probably for good reason, I think.
Yeah.
I did a lot
Dad
of,
was too busy watching black and white movies.
Yeah, well, better that, I think.
You only had five channels.
Only five channels.
How are you doing, Hanako? How's the sleep deprivation?
I
that's good.
I'm surviving, not thriving. I think I got about 2 hours sleep. Filmed until 5 a.m. Got in a car. Got back to the hotel at 5:30. Couldn't get to sleep for ages because it was light outside. The birds were singing. People were waking up.
Yeah.
Wild.
Clashing around. Yeah. And then just
very inconsiderate of them.
I haven't slept.
Well, some interesting content from you today then, I'm sure.
I'm going to be a ball of fun.
It's a bit like No Filter Hanako. I'm excited.
Yeah, very excited.
If you just look over and I've just fallen asleep, please let me just...
just let me sleep.
Kick you onto the table. Yeah, I'm like, we'll kick her. And Kat's like, we'll sing you lullabies. We'll love you from afar.
I'm a shell of a woman, but I'm very excited.
I'm glad you're here.
How are you guys?
Thank you. Good.
Perky. I'm good.
A lot more alive than me.
A lot more perky. Mm. I'm ready to go. I'm nervous, actually.
Yeah.
I'm very nervous.
It's quite nervous doing the episode.
It is.
Yeah.
Nervous? That's not how you say it.
Nerve-wracking.
Nerve-wracking.
It's quite nervous.
I said it with such conviction. You were so polite. You were like, it is. It is nervous.
We love you, even if the grammar's not correct.
So wrong. Grammar?
Grammar?
Vote. Grammar or language? I don't know.
Language, probably. Grammar would be...
Grammar,
yeah. Also.
Oh, fucking hell.
This is going well. Okay. Well, today we have quite a mammoth...
Task.
Yeah, we're going to look at what's been, well, was a huge sensation. When did Dirty John come out on Netflix?
Well, I have no idea because I don't know this story at all.
It completely passed us by.
Yeah. What were we doing? What were you doing? Because everyone watched it.
God.
But yeah, a mammoth topic, mainly because obviously these are real people, different from like Henry VIII. You know, I don't think any of them are knocking about except for maybe in spiritual or reincarnation form, whereas a lot of people in this story are still alive. So hopefully we won't do it a disservice, but yeah, I'm going tentatively forward,
yes,
knowing that I could fuck this up real good.
You are primed and ready, Hannah.
But we couldn't not do it because, first of all, I'm so astounded. So you know nothing about this story at all.
I just know that Eric Banner played him in a Netflix series.
Yes.
Oh, is the Netflix series fiction?
No. It's based, I mean, some of it is...
based on the true story.
The story's true, but it was a TV show.
Yeah. So they made... created the story and they put, and obviously some of it is fictionalized or like not sensationalized, like kind of made a little bit more dramatic.
Yes, but to like be honest, Made in Chelsea.
Exactly like Made in Chelsea. No, but it is like it's real people's lives, and they were very much involved in the TV series, I believe.
Wow.
Actually, for good reason, because I think so much of it was put out there in order to be like a warning to other women or people about very dangerous people that do genuinely live among us. So John met Deborah in 2014, but there is a whole history in it.
Really recently.
Really not long ago at all, not even a decade ago. But it does sort of, the story spans a great deal of time, and we will be delving into all sorts of different time periods within John's lifetime. Mm. But kind of where we're kicking off is 2014. Oh. But yes, not a single piece of knowledge about this story from you.
Not a snickerel.
Not a snickerel.
You made that word up.
And this is what I was expecting.
Over here.
Not a snickerel.
not a bloody snickerel. Okay, well, great. So I first heard this story on the podcast, the Chris Gofford podcast that he created. I think it's 6 parts, and he goes really in depth into the story.
Oh, I love it. Is it and really then, like case file-y?
But he actually is having proper interviews with all of the people who are involved in the story. And so you're hearing them talking and giving their side of it. So if you haven't heard that, just go and listen to it. It is so, like, pause now and go listen to it, because I'm going to spoilers for the entire story.
Yeah.
But I did also watch the Netflix series, and I got some information from the godsend that is Wikipedia.
Yeah, you read all the books.
And I read all the books.
You went to the place where it happened.
Oh, yeah. Totally. I did that.
Oh my God, you look so nervous.
So nervous.
No, just so you know, we don't read books on for any of these podcasts.
No, I mean, actually, Harry Potter. For Harry Potter.
Oh, yeah, she read a lot. Yeah. Talked about myself in the third person. That was weird.
Always.
Sinus is catching.
Yeah. The narcissism of John is already infiltrating this room. Yeah. So... this story mainly centres around Deborah Newell, who is, she honestly sounds like a true icon for what she's done to spread the story afterwards. But at the time when the story began in 2014, she was 59. She had been married and divorced 4 times. So
what a trooper.
Oh, yeah. Mm. She'd put up with a lot of shit by this point already.
That is so impressive. Like, honestly, I go through one relationship and I'm like, I need years off.
Yeah.
When it ends. Like, yeah, that's years.
That's like one a decade.
Also, like, your faith in love is so strong. And I think that's really, really admirable of her character.
Amazing.
Kind of also her downfall, I guess, in the sense of having so much blind faith. But it's really nice knowing that, like... you know, because my mum, she's got a boyfriend, but like, I think there was a point I remember where she was like, oh, maybe that's not there for me anymore. Yeah. Mm. And that's quite often the narrative that women kind of only get to date men who are like 10 years their senior. Yeah. And that's why it's really hard to find a partner, especially when you're nearly 60. But also, I have to say, she had like a flourishing business. She was an interior designer and had built this business from scratch. And she was really wealthy and had like made a really brilliant name for herself.
Wow.
So she was prime for dodgy blokes on the internet.
God, want to take that wealth, take that joy, take that.
Yes. And also she's really beautiful. Like she's a really gorgeous hot woman.
Yeah, paint a picture for us. What does she look like?
She's got, well, she was played by Connie Britton and she's incredibly beautiful. She was, so Deborah was online dating and she'd had a few bad dates and oh boy, have I had my fair share of bad online dates and I know what they can do to your soul and to your general well-being. So, I mean, you lasted how long on Hinge, Kath?
It was 36 hours.
Not even 48?
No, not even 2 days.
What happened at the 36th hour?
I thought, fuck this.
Life's too short.
It was like about to start having to actually have conversations with other humans.
Oh God.
Through an interweb. And I'd never met them in my life. And I thought, I'm not 16. Well, you, I can't have this.
You know
this.
On Hinge, like, you've got, you, like, what's your favourite colour? Oh, no. Finish this sentence.
They give you, like prompts.
Is, yeah. So what were your, what were
my
those?
Prompts? One of them is, what kind of texter are you? And I put the kind that turns her notifications off and then gets upset that no one's texting her.
That's really
so
good.
True. So me.
To be fair, my Hinge answer was, what's the best present you've ever received? And I put a bouquet of cucumbers, which I actually got from Kath for my birthday.
Oh my God. Your obsession with cucumbers is second unrivaled. To none.
Do you know what though? Okay, no one can argue with me on this. 96% water, that cucumber is a goddamn miracle. That is a miracle food.
That is a miracle.
And do you want to know something else? True. I learned today. Learned this today. If you put sugar on a cucumber, it tastes like a watermelon.
Shut up.
Because same content of water.
You can just take the beers and see what you think. So go to beer52, that's the numbers 52.com /fboy for your free pints today.
Okay, we're getting distracted. Let's get back to the story.
Oh, sorry, Deborah.
Sorry, back, Deborah. We are really making...
No, she's a hot gal. She's thriving business.
Yeah, and she's been having some really bad online dates.
Oh, yes, that's why.
So I think he was about like the third or the fourth person she went on a date with. He said he was a doctor. He was very attractive. He really was a very attractive man. He was also Christian, which was very important to her. Mm. He said he had multiple cars and houses. And most importantly, he was 6'2".
Woof.
Woof.
And we know you can be ugly as sin and have the personality of a plank.
Yeah.
But if you're 6'2", you're getting laid.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
You're going to get climbed like a tree.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, literally. Literally. And it's also like, I thought this was very important that her last boyfriend or person that she dated had said that she was too fat and that also she wasn't his type. And then when she met John, he was like, you're so beautiful and you are just my type. And it's that circle of hurt, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, disgusting, appalling. But it's when someone like gives you an insecurity.
Oh, yeah.
If someone else is like, I don't know, rubbing some balm on that burn, then you're like, oh, fantastic. They're amazing.
Yes.
Yeah, totally.
And dangers they actually had
love bombing, isn't
it? Yeah, exactly. And they had a really good first date, like in the Netflix series. You see them like having a wonderful time together and he walks her back and he comes into her flat. And then there are a few red flags here. Mm. The first one is he's wearing bad clothes.
Oh, no. Oh, no. I found a conversation about this the weekend with my friend Abigail.
Did you?
We were just rinsing everyone at the hotel. Like, it's the cargo shorts with the incessant amount of pockets.
Love them.
What are you putting in the pockets?
What's in there?
What are you hiding?
Well, that's the thing. He actually turned up in cargo shorts in the Netflix series. Imagine getting your ankles out on the first day.
So is that what you mean? He's had bad clothes, so it was like he's not a doctor.
Well, first of all...
No, it's just like, it's not hot.
It's just, yeah.
But so, is that a red flag?
So, no, the red flag is that he kind of looks a bit homeless, actually.
And it's not in a hipster way?
No.
2014
was just
pre-hipster.
But it's a fine line, isn't it? Between being cool and looking homeless.
Oh, yeah, you walk down a street in Shoreditch and you think, I'm just not sure.
Yeah, I'm uncertain.
Exactly.
Here.
But the main red flag from this first date is that when they got back, he jumped on her bed and was like, oh, this is amazing. It's so comfortable. And then he wouldn't. She was like, I think we should like get out. And he was just refusing to leave.
On a first date?
On a first date. And then
in cargo shorts?
Yeah, most importantly. Take them off first.
Absolutely. No,
don't do that. Definitely
don't
do that.
Take them off.
But yeah, it was a huge red flag because he wouldn't get off. And then he left. He kind of left in a strop.
Oh.
And she was really gutted about that. But then he apologized and kind of made her feel very special.
Yeah.
And so she was like, you know, I think when you have those rose-tinted glasses on, the red flags just look like flags,
you've
right?
also just been, like, trained since birth
to ignore them. This is true. But the red flags did continue because they were dating. And three main red flags that really appeared to me. The first one was that he, because he was a doctor, he wore scrubs. But he would always wear the same pair of scrubs.
Oh.
And he would wear them to, like, formal events. Like, for example, she invited him to a charity gala and he turned up in his scrubs. And she's wearing, like, a full ball gown.
What?
And she's just like, oh, he's just such a busy doctor. He's so busy, he doesn't have time to get his cargo pants back on. I don't know.
But oh, please, no.
Again, those rose-tinted glasses are actually better. Keep them off. Do not put them on again.
Scrubs on. Wait, do you mean the blue...
Yeah, the blue, like, doctor scrubs.
Well, that's odd.
Very odd.
So they're a bit grubby.
They're a bit grubby, but not like grubby with like blood or anything. Like just like general grub, which is a red flag.
What about the hat?
No, no.
The hat, the mask.
Yeah, the mask, the gloves.
His visor.
The latex gloves. He was always wearing a glove.
Like his shoes were covered in the plastic thing.
In the blue plastic shoes.
He has that scene.
Yeah. At all times. Red flag, red flag.
That's a red flag.
The other red flag was he said that he loved her on the third date.
Oh, no.
Very love bombing. And the other thing that he said, and it was by text, was he said, I'm the best thing that will ever happen to you.
What? Disagree. Strongly disagree.
If anything, the worst thing that ever happened to her.
From 1 to 5, how strongly do you disagree? I disagree 5.
5. Wait, out of 10?
Out of 10.
No, 1 to 5. You know, on those quizzes.
Oh, yeah. Strongly disagree. He started staying over regularly at Deborah's house, and her daughter, Jacqueline, started thinking that he was dodgy. From the moment she met him, she thought he looked homeless. And then at one point, this is actually so iconic from her, and I love it. She had a massive safe full of designer handbags.
Oh my God.
And her reason was because you can resell them for like the original price.
Yeah.
She was in the safe and he like stood by the door, and it's done really well in the Netflix series. He's like, hey kiddo, what's in there? And she's like, none of your business. It was like the second time she'd ever met him. Really, really strange. And he was like just constantly prying, always being there. And so it caused
lurking.
A riff.
Lots of lurking.
Lurking. And it caused a riff. And so Jacqueline was like, I'm going to move out. Deborah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh,
and it was putting like such a strain on it because Deborah felt like she had to lie because her daughter didn't like him. But also she was like, it's my chance at love. So it was just causing a real issue. And also Deborah was like, people haven't liked my husbands in the past. There were 4 of them and not all of them were particularly nice. So again, like it's amazing how many times we can make the same mistake.
Cyclical behaviour.
Yeah, exactly. But what she ended up doing was she found a secret place with John and said to her daughter, like, you know, this is causing a rift for us. They were in therapy together. And she was like, I think it'd be better if you just stay here in this flat and I'm going to move into another flat. And she moved in with John. And John said, you know, I can't have my name on the lease due to quote unquote tax problems.
Oh, no.
So she paid for everything. And she paid for everything up front. God. She put loads of money down on this flat. And it was really hard for her because no one...
Where is this in America, can I ask?
I think it's California. I think, I'm pretty sure it's Los Angeles.
Right. You know, real estate is not cheap.
No, it's not cheap.
Yeah.
And also they were getting like beautiful views. Oh, these apartments were gorgeous, especially in the Netflix series, on my word. So it was very, very expensive. Like tens of thousands of dollars. And it was hard for her because, you know, everyone was being like, he's really dodgy, we don't like him. But he cooked and cleaned for her. He got her coffee every morning. He took her car in for maintenance. He carried her purse. I mean, the bar was in hell, but she was just thinking he was a godsend because he did the bare minimum for her, which is a real problem.
Yeah.
Also, like, when you're trying to support someone who has a shit boyfriend, you kind of give them the benefit of the doubt because you're like, oh, you're telling me all the shit stuff, but I don't get to see the good
stuff,
right?
You do,
you do. Yeah.
Yeah, and also, if they're making you happy, who am I to say that they're not a good person?
Yeah. And Jacqueline was like, nah, he's just a piece of shit. Whereas her other daughter, Tara, who was, like, described as the sweetest, loveliest, like, kindest, most gentle girl, really gave him a chance, but she eventually was worn down by his very strange behavior.
Oh my gosh.
And his hazmat suit.
Yeah, and his hazmat suit.
Hazmat suit.
It really, really, like she was willing to suspend all of her the things that she took from Jacqueline and gave him a chance, but he was very rude to her.
Oh my god.
And to Tara.
To Tara as well.
So he was doing that classic thing of pushing away the people who were close to her.
Yeah.
How old are the daughters, like, roughly? Are they, like, teenagers?
Oh, no, they're, like, 20s. Like,
oh, okay.
Yeah. Kind of at that point where you start to be, like, friends with your mum as well.
Right,
like,
yeah.
Which is really hard because they were close with her. Yeah. Really close. And it was causing a real strain. Like, and he was making it very hard for Deborah to see her daughters. And Tara started to notice as well, like, you know, he was driving Deborah's car all the time. And he would spend all day playing Call of Duty.
That's huge.
The biggest one I've heard so far.
And the biggest one as well, her Tara had loads of dogs because she worked
at... didn't like the dogs?
The dogs are really anxious around him.
Freaks me out.
It's like when you're with an animal and then they suddenly look up and they see something that you can't see.
Yeah.
And you're like, there's a fucking ghost.
Well, there's a fuckboy in our midst. Yeah. So there's loads that I'm sort of skimming over here around the nuances of, like, the reasons why they fought and they fell out. But there was a particular row in which John got very angry because Tara was starting to question him and question his past. And it all came to a head on Thanksgiving. And it ended up that Deborah kicked Tara out on Thanksgiving with her boyfriend. But kind of because John was obviously stirring the pot and being like, choose between her and me.
Well, he's really wiggled his way in there.
And he really, and I think as well, when it's like you're in that newfound throes of love and he's sort of saying to her, like, your children are just there for your inheritance. Yeah. They don't care about you. I really love you.
Yeah. It's such a classic manipulative technique and it works.
Oh, totally. It works.
Doing these giving actions of mowing the lawn and getting your laundry and cooking and cleaning.
Yeah.
Doing all this stuff that Deborah probably has never experienced from another person.
Or just being like, the bar was so low before that.
Yeah.
That him simply asking about her day. Like she says that. She's like, he asked about my day. And that was enough.
Yeah.
Like that is so wild how easy it is when you've been used to such terrible behavior to wiggle your way in and pretend that you're like going above and beyond.
Yeah. Yeah.
Really not. But it was definitely causing a huge strain, and like Christmas was coming up and all of that. And it was just making the family super tense. But again, Deborah was just falling more and more in love with him because he was helping her get over a breakup where someone cheated on her and making her feel worthy. Mm, he was begging her to marry him like endlessly. Which, if you weren't that into someone, would be so creepy after 2 months being like, please, 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 marry me.
Months.
2 months. And also, by this point, he was letting her dress him. So, like, he was getting hot.
Thank God for that.
Yeah, honestly, thank God. Get rid of the scrubs. Cargo. Get rid of the cargo
the
pants.
The cargo shorts need to go away.
Yeah. So, really alienated. And after 2 months, they had a spur of the moment marriage.
God.
And no one knew about it.
Oh.
Yeah.
Where did they get married?
I think it was somewhere like on like
a registry office.
It was, and you can see the video online as well on YouTube, and it's just
that's all online.
Kind of in the Netflix series, and it's really sad as well because they look really they're happy.
Yeah,
but again, like it caused such huge rifts, and there was like a really difficult Christmas where he was being very performative and like playing with all the kids, and it really upset Tara because Tara didn't like him, and it was just really difficult.
The
for
kids of Tara and
like the grandkids of the family and like cousins and things like that, and Tara was so sweet, sort of being like, you know, you've had four husbands prior to this. Like, I don't want the kids to get attached. And then he's gone. And also, he's a fucking creep. And he's being weird. And it was just causing massive risks and being very much like, are we going to choose John or are we going to choose...
A big, big family drama.
That was massive.
Like, creating big rifts between everyone.
Yeah, huge.
So stressful.
Very stressful. So behind the scenes, Jacqueline was just like, I'm not having any of this shit. I'm going to hire a PI and I'm going to look
at Oh my God, Jacqueline!
Yes, we rate her.
What does Jacqueline do?
She works as an assistant, I believe, for her father, who actually was a doctor or worked in medicine.
Because I was going to ask about him. Where is he in the picture?
Right. Yeah, I think he's just elsewhere. Mm-hmm. She works for him in like as a...
Right, so like a father that's around and very much there, but just not in...
Not really part of this story necessarily, but she did work for him. She worked on the front desk and she was like, the doctors would always have very clean.
Yeah.
And the scrubs, and also
really he had... Rooted out, yeah.
He had dirty fingernails.
Oh, no.
And she said, "That's a tell, you can't be a doctor if you have dirty fingernails. Telltale sign.
Telltale sign.
That is a telltale,
telltale.
So this PI starts investigating and he finds out straight away he's not a doctor. He's a nurse. He has a bankruptcy on his record. He had addresses all over the place, but no, like, multiple homes, like he said. And the last one was, like, his one that was registered somewhere that he was living, was a trailer park. And so Shad, who is Deborah's nephew, but for reasons I'll come to explain, is basically like a son to her, called the trailer park and spoke to the woman who owned it.
Oh,
and
my God.
She was like, "I used to fuck him."
Don't go there. I used to fuck him.
Yeah. Well, said that he just disappeared.
So, I mean, big fat liar.
Massive. But his last actual address was jail. And he had said that during that time he had been in Iraq. So for the time which he was away,
so he's painting himself as a war hero, but he was actually in jail.
Yeah.
Which, like, disclose.
Yeah, just disclose.
Just disclose.
He's hiding.
Yeah.
It's so sad because when Deborah is told this information, she just ignores it. She just chooses to believe it's not true because she thinks, well, John has gotten into her head and made her believe that her kids just want her inheritance. They want her dead. He's become, like, super protective over her. Like, anyone who catcalls her in the street, he's like puffs his chest and is getting really angry and like, really proving how much he loves her.
Being a manly man.
Exactly. Really, like, being very Gaston about it.
With his dirty fingernails.
Yes, with beating his chest with dirty fingernails. Oh. And one of the reasons which I think probably drew them really close was one time when they came home to their flat, there was just a random woman in their flat.
What?
Yeah. And when she's reflecting on this, she's like, oh, maybe John knew this woman because it was just quite a strange interaction. He instantly went for her, called the police. She was out. Deborah never got to speak to the woman, never. It was all, like, very swept up. But off the back of this, he was like, we need to get security cameras installed all in this house and where you work.
Ooh.
Even though very safe neighborhood, very expensive area, like, really not very necessary.
How did she get in?
Yeah, good question. But again, turning a blind eye. Exactly. So she does that and she gets cameras installed, which means she's being watched
24/7. That's terrifying.
But what she does come to realize is she can watch him too. So she starts thinking, like, I'll have a little look through the cameras. And again, another reason why she buys into all of his lies is he has excuses for everything. So for one day he, like, gets up. He's like, I'm going to the hospital. He leaves.
5 minutes later,
comes back and starts sleeping again.
Oh my God, that's horrifying.
So she's like, oh, can I say anything to him? I'm scared how he's going to react. But eventually she's like, why did you do that? And he's like, oh, just because the surgery was cancelled. And so this happens on repeat. He has excuses for every little thing. Like, you know, your kids are saying this, they want you dead. You've been skipping work. Oh, it's because it was cancelled. It wasn't until she found a letter from an inmate in their post box, which he saw her reading on the camera, and then he storms out. He's like, why are you reading my post? That's a felony. Popped meat the kettle. Like, what the hell?
So creepy that he was watching her on CCTV. That's fucking crazy.
Yeah,
from
exactly.
The other room.
From the other room. And also how consistently he must be watching her in order to catch that not only she's reading mail, that she's reading his mail. Like, just wild. So finally now she's feeling suspicious. It took a while, but we got there. She's seeing the light a little bit. The rose tint is fading.
Oh my God.
And she starts going through his documents and she finds multiple arrests, stalking and possession of firearms, restraining orders from ex-girlfriends, jail time for violating those restraining orders, prison time for stealing drugs in multiple places, found loads and loads of murder equipment, including cyanide in his apartment. Printouts of women reporting him online, being like, don't trust this man. He will take you for all your money and blackmail you, blah, blah, blah. Just like kept like trophies for him.
I was about to say, why has he kept all these documents? It's like hardcore proof he's a psychopath.
It is. It's that, isn't it? You keep
trophies.
Mementos.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of like a serial killer does, like keeping things from the crime scene. Even though it will obviously incriminate them
so
badly.
That is terrifying.
Yeah.
That's like a nightmare within a nightmare.
She'd found out that he got out of jail on the 8th of October in 2014. He met Deborah on October the 10th, 2014. So when he'd thrown herself on that mattress.
He'd only slept in a...
He'd been homeless. So he literally was like, this mattress feels amazing because he'd been sleeping in a prison cell.
I cannot believe I didn't know this fucking story.
Absolutely wild. And obviously this is just like a broad overarching view of the beginning part of this story. There's so much more nuance, which you can hear.
Want to watch the Netflix series now.
You should, because I'm really like, you know, only giving you basic facts here. There are so many more creepy things that he did and that she found and that was ignored. It's and the love bombing was wild.
Those like gut-wrenching, blood-curdling moments when you realise something about someone that you've been fucking living with and you are married to.
Yeah.
You realise you're living with a stranger.
Yeah.
That is horrifying.
Yeah, really
scary.
You've
shared a bed with.
For months. And he loves you and you've made love multiple times. Like, that's terrifying.
And you have a house together.
Yeah.
That is terrifying.
Exactly.
What
so
do you do?
The only, like, I guess, stroke of luck and the place where the universe just came back to her and handed her just the right thing to happen was he got a stomach injury. And so he was in hospital for 3 weeks as she found this out. So she kind of got the opportunity to leave without him, like, physically entrapping her, essentially.
So that stomach ache gave her a chance to raid through his stuff, essentially, and figure out who
he was. I actually
think
she raided through it before, and then it just so happened that the timing was.
Oh, wow.
Because obviously then you're like, I'm dealing with someone really, really dangerous. So it was perfect timing for him to get a stomach injury and for him to be in the hospital so that she could get out.
Yeah.
But I think I kind of just wanted to reflect a little bit on the amount of love bombing and the things that can... Because obviously this is such an extreme version, but we've all experienced moments where people will be like, I love you so much, you're amazing, you are, I'm like nothing without you, and you're nothing without me. Mm. And that just kind of can make you feel like suspend your ability to see red flags completely.
Yeah.
Which is so problematic.
It's like a drug. It's because it's so extreme.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel so high.
Totally. Like someone loving you that much after having so...
Over to drink-trip.com and get 15% off your first order, including free shipping with the code FBOY.
Take a trip to happy days and go to drink-trip.com and use the code FBOY for 15% off.
And free shipping.
Go get your chill on, gals. The patriarchy's hard enough.
It's true.
So... I'm going to go back a little bit and we're going to talk about how John Meehan became John Meehan.
Oh, this is so good, Hannah.
So, well, I mean, not my story, but wow. Like, imagine being like, have I got a story for you of my life? Like, this is
also,
just...
on the fifth husband, you're like, are you joking?
Oh, gosh.
Are you fucking kidding me?
Truly, truly. Have you not been through enough? I mean, wow. But John Meehan, he...
John Meehan, that's his name.
Yeah.
John Meehan.
Meehan, M-E-A-N?
M-E-E-H-A-N, or John Meehan, I guess.
Meehan, okay.
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So he, this is, when I was listening to the podcast, my jaw was practically on the floor during the section because I couldn't believe how many references to other fuckboys there were. So he was a very smart young man, but he didn't want to do any work. So he just kind of cruised through school. He really resented his mother because his parents got divorced, even though his dad would do things like run him over and then get him to be run over by a car so that then they can sue that person and get money for it.
What?
So he did hate his dad as well, but he resented his mum really strongly for ruining their family.
Whoa, wait. His own dad would get him to run in front of cars as a child.
I believe as a young man. I don't know exactly how old he was at that time. But even things like he would put broken glass in his Taco Bell so that he could sue them. Like loads of stuff. He was running so many scams.
Oh my God.
But as a youngster, he was obsessed with James Bond. And he even had a number plate that was MEE007. Because he was like, it's amazing how he womanizes, he's about the law, like all of those things. He really glorified
Mr. Narcissist.
Mr. Narcissist. Yeah. Like terrible.
Classic fucking fuckboy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think having that as like, oh look, he is so glorified and the world thinks that he's brilliant.
Yes.
This is when we fall into problems, right?
Yeah, and it's like the I will only be accepted into this world if I am this thing.
Yeah.
It is like super impressive, super masculine, super flashy, super rich, gets all the women.
Doesn't give a fuck, kills at will.
Yeah. Does anything in order for his version of the greater good, which whatever he deems it to be at that time, which is not always what MI5 is telling him it is as well. Yeah. Like he is, like James Bond is in charge of James Bond, not MI5.
Yeah.
But yeah, obsessed with him. And he was just treating women so badly, like constantly having affairs. He got the name Dirty John because of the way that he treated women. They also called him Filthy John or just Filthy.
Oh.
Like his nails. Disgusting. The fact that he had such dirty nails and he still managed to get women is just beyond me. But still. Yeah. And all his friends.
Ooh. I bet he didn't clip them either.
No, no way. I bet he had a long one just for picking his nose.
Can you imagine his toenails?
Oh, grim.
His toenails.
They would scratch you in bed at night.
Really cold toes.
Giant big toenail. Really just a fat big toenail.
And really thick, like yellowy cut.
Got a fungus growing on it.
So gross. Yeah, so gross. And all of his friends who he lived with knew absolutely nothing about him. He was like a ghost, essentially. Which is, again,
007.
007. But when he was in college, he was training to be a doctor. And he picked up a lovely, beautiful girl called Tonya Sales. He was cheating on her. But regardless, in 1990, all his friends were very confused because they got married. And
He's good looking, right?
He was good looking. And that, he was also training to be a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, lots of things. And he was obviously like super charismatic and all of those various other things that genuine psychopaths are.
Yeah.
And he's playing into that delusional dream of 007, which, you
exactly.
know,
who's definitely people find psychopath. That attractive.
And then listen to this little number. So at the wedding, all of his friends are really confused because they said it was like a Don Draper wedding because none of his family were there. He had no guests because he had told Tonya, who was his fiance, that all of his family were addicts, which actually turns out to be very ironic. He just lied and none of his guests were there. And all of his friends, you can listen to their wedding speeches. They're all being like, he's Dirty John. We never thought he'd be getting married.
Oh my God. So that's why they were so surprised. Because he's just,
exactly. So then during the marriage, he flunked out of medical school and Tonya paid for him to go through nurse or anesthesiologist school. So he becomes an anesthesiologist.
That's terrifying.
That's terrifying.
You don't want a psychopath in charge of anesthesia.
Oh, yeah. And that is where this story gets very, very dark.
Oh, fuck.
Also, during the marriage, they have two kids and they have a full life together. And she's really supported him. But in September 2000, 10 years into the marriage, he says he wants a divorce.
Any reason?
Oh, no, I don't think so. I don't think he really even gave her a reason. I think it was just, I just want to get a divorce. So even though he has always forbidden Tonya from calling or speaking to any members of his family, after 10 years, she breaks her promise to him and she calls his mum. And his mum reveals to him, to Tonya, that he is actually 5 years older than he says he is. He had changed his name to Jonathan.
Why bother? Like 5 years up, why bother?
Because in college, I guess it's a big difference.
Oh, college,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, they're young. And it is, you know, even being in the like educational system 5 years later on makes for a different kind of dynamic. He changed his name to Jonathan from just John, so you couldn't track him on the internet or anything.
Oh, that's
like that.
Crazy.
Makes him sound smarter.
Not crazy.
Elongating the name.
Elongate that name.
That extra syllable really makes you sound smart. He'd been arrested in the early 80s for selling cocaine and turned in his best friend.
Snitch. He's a snitch.
He's a snitch too. And then his mum asks, is he still doing drugs? So Tonya then finds out that the hardcore drugs he was supposed to be giving patients, he was addicted to.
Oh my God.
So he was stealing it from patients, leaving them in pain after surgery, and just taking their medication, which he had become very, very addicted to.
Opioids.
Yeah, essentially.
She was just constantly high as a kite.
Yeah, which also is because she, on the podcast, there's an interview with Tonya and she's saying, you know, you're 95% of the time, you're just sat around doing nothing. But you have to be so, like 99% of the time, I think she says, because, you know, nothing really goes wrong. But if that was
a surgeon.
Well, as an anesthesiologist.
Yeah. Right.
But if you fuck it up, you fuck it up massive.
Yeah, fucking
And wow. so you cannot, you have to be on it.
Yeah.
So she's instantly like, nope, no way. She reports him to the police from the off. Obviously, John is like absolutely furious.
Yeah.
Mm-mm. And he gets put in jail. It's also very strange because you hear like calls between Tonya and John and they're like fighting furiously 1 second and then the next second they're talking about getting nappies for their kid because they have shared custody. Like it is so wild how much he is playing victim and twisting the stories. There's letters of him in jail where he's saying like he's the victim from his parents, from his ex, that he's been injured and that's why he's addicted to the painkillers. Like he just takes no responsibility while he's in jail.
Wow.
Terrible. But even still, he's so fortunate because he has a lovely family. And when he gets out of jail, his sister helps him out. She does everything. She pays off his debts. She helps him with his kids, getting visitation rights, everything. And on the first night when he comes to stay with her, as soon as he gets out of jail, she looks at what he's doing on the computer and he's on Match.com. First thing he does. He's just obsessed with women, obsessed with conning them. It's horrendous. So he was like meeting women online, conning them, stealing their money. He was also meeting women at the hospital when he's getting help for his back. He's just everywhere he can. He is just left, right and center taking advantage of women, even to the point where he tries to sue his sister who paid off all of his debts.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And she had to get a restraining order and sue him back in order to get him to leave her alone.
Oh my God. That's oh my horrific. God.
Just relentless, absolutely horrendously, like horrendously and relentlessly harassing and conning women. It's just repetitive. Even men as well in jail. Yeah. Like there was sort of conversation about him like being in romantic relationships with men, particularly in jail, and just repeatedly doing the same thing to them.
So every time he's conning them, it's through love, it's through manipulation. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, through romantic manipulation. And he's just obsessed with humiliating people who defy his will in any way.
Fucking hell.
And it's that thing of like, he had a really tough childhood, clearly. Yeah. When I say he had a lovely family, he had a lovely sister. I don't really know much about his mum. He hated his mum and obviously his dad, bad bloke.
Well, yeah, it kind of sounds like he's just repeating what his dad did to him.
Yeah.
To others.
Exactly.
And I wonder maybe he hates his mum because she didn't stand up for that or she didn't look after him and he's decided to put all the blame on her.
Yeah, which is deeply unfair because she's just trying to survive as well.
Yeah.
And I guess it's that thing of like hurt people, hurting people, and it explains it, but it definitely doesn't justify it.
Yeah. It's like people have the same thing and they don't.
And interesting how he has a sister who is clearly really kind-hearted and loving and able to care for us and be generous.
Who must have had the same upbringing.
Operate like a normal human being.
Yeah, very interesting.
I mean, we don't know the same upbringing, but maybe similar.
So I guess that's kind of what makes John Meehan, John Meehan. But also that fuckboyery glorification around like James Bond and
Don Draper.
Like these ideas that's what makes you a man and you can just treat women like they're indisposable. Like,
and
so
this
bad.
Like a mystery that surrounds him and rather than
that
like...
he's like cultivated though, right? That he's like, he's trying to sell this dream of who he wants to be as opposed to who he actually is because he's so ashamed of who he is.
Yeah, exactly. So going back to where we were with Deborah, he is now in the hospital and he has this stomach injury and he realizes that she's left and he starts threatening her, accusing her of stealing from him. Hilarious. And
what does she have to steal?
Well, exactly.
His documents.
He also accuses her of hitting him. So he starts doing this thing of being like, you've done this and trying to get evidence. So, you know, she's now fearing that he's going to go to the police about her, even though he's got no evidence or anything like that. But he also starts to ridicule her for her age and her looks, which is just so demoralizing.
That's fucking evil.
And kind of the other side of lovebombing.
Yeah,
that's
totally
fucking evil. What
he
gave her,
he takes away.
Snatching away.
Cat.
You're so in sync.
But that's because it's what it is.
It is what it is.
Yeah.
And obviously, like, this is the thing. This is such an extreme version, right? But we've also had it where you go on a date with someone, they're like, oh my God, this is the best date ever. You're incredible. I think I'm in love with you. And then they don't text you for 3 days.
Yeah. How many times have you been in a bar and someone's like, you're so fit? And then you're like, I'm not interested. And they're like, you're fucking ugly.
Oh my God. So many times.
3 seconds apart.
Exactly.
And you know it's just manipulation. Yeah. They're just using these sweet, sweet words to fucking manipulate the shit out of
you. And then they want to make you feel as shit as they feel. I don't know.
Yeah,
they want to put it back on you.
Embarrassed and rejected. Exactly. So he's completely changed his tune. And she was terrified at this point. She was changing hotels, wearing wigs.
Oh my God.
And she was advised to get a gun. But...
by who?
Well, for her own protection.
Yeah, because but as in by...
Welcome to America.
Mm-hmm. Welcome to America. But actually, there is a history there as well, which is important.
Ooh.
So Deborah had a sister who...
Had
a sister who was married, and when she was very beautiful, she got married, I think. She got engaged at 17. As soon as she turned 18, she got married.
Wow.
And this husband, eventually, it didn't work out. And when she told her husband that she was going to leave him, he shot and killed her. So Deborah has this very sad relationship with trauma around guns and refuses to get a gun for that reason. But also this plays into the dynamic of the family too. Like the family, I think we've already lost one member of our family to a dangerous man. And, you know, we don't want to lose another woman who we care about. So she didn't get a gun to arm herself or anything like that. And she also was just, I guess, so believing that that people are good, that she just wanted to kind of put it all to bed. And anyway, she was advised to show him the will, her will, to say, you're not the beneficiary, don't kill me because you won't benefit from it.
Oh my God, that's fucked up.
But she goes and does it in person. While she's there, John convinces her that he had been set up and that none of these stories were true.
What? How can you do that?
Yeah,
I know.
Like, how can you turn all this evidence around?
He had excuses for everything, says that restraining orders were actually a different John, maybe a Jonathan Meehan, and the theft of drugs were, you know, he lied to her about them because she was so beautiful and brilliant, and, you know, the cruel text that he was sending her, he was just really high on the drugs in hospital. You know, she says, like, he could convince her it was 95 degrees when it was snowing outside.
Yeah.
It was just gaslighting of, like, the highest degree.
But it's like those people that don't break out in a sweat when they get caught out, and it's like, no, rather than like admitting the truth, they just push on.
Yeah,
they push on and push on.
They double down.
Yeah, they double the fuck down. Yeah.
And that's what he did. And so she did believe him. And so all the family thought she'd gone out of this relationship and that she was going to annul the marriage, but she actually retracted the request, didn't tell anyone, and within 2 months she had moved back into a new flat with him.
Oh, honey.
And she said that she was keeping her guard up, but he was just so good and she was so in love with him. She just bought all of these stories. And it's very interesting because on the podcast they discuss how with Deborah's sister, Deborah's mum forgave her sister's murderer. She even testified for him in trial, saying that Cindy, who is Deborah's sister, had mistreated him and she was making excuses for him. And in the end, his name is Billy, only went to jail for 2 years and 9 months and 9 days.
But I mean, you know, as you said, they're Christians, right?
Yeah.
The biggest thing about Christianity is forgiveness.
It's forgiveness, yeah. And even though Debbie couldn't forgive him, I suppose there's an element of being like that forgiveness maybe kind of went through her as well. And then she ended up forgiving John and, you know, and at this point as well, like John was going to the church with her. He would come and repent. He would literally cry during services and he would just play the perpetual victim. But it was ruining the family and everyone was worried about losing another family member. It was getting very, very scary.
God, it's terrifying. That's
it's really
utterly
terrifying. Yeah, and of course there's loads of nuance over the time, but eventually the cracks once again started to show once that, like, love, you know, when he couldn't keep up the appearances because he got lazy time and time again.
But that's that thing, right? You want to have hope. You want to believe in the goodness of people.
Yeah.
If you don't have hope, what do you have?
Exactly.
And I, you know, people can take that to really dangerous extremes.
Totally. And I think also because at this point she was seeing the cracks and being like, oh fuck, I've really fucked this up again.
Yeah.
But she was too embarrassed and ashamed to do anything about it. And so she, like, spoke to therapists, which is a very smart thing to do. Yeah. And they said, you know, you can't just leave. You've got to plan leaving now because you've got to play happy wife for
Big Little Lies.
Yeah.
Like those amazing scenes with the therapist when Nicole Kidman goes to her and she's like, your husband is hitting you. She's like, she gets up to go and she's like, so when should we book the next one? And she's like, for what? She's like, we need to make a plan.
For you to leave.
Yeah.
And that is what she does. But as she starts to pull away, he starts to tighten his
claws.
And so on their 1 year anniversary, so it's been going on for a year.
Oh my
now.
God.
Only a year.
Only a year. Yeah.
So much has happened.
Yeah, so much has happened. And so he writes her this ridiculously long letter and he says, one part of it, he says, happy anniversary. 1 year and forever means forever. We've been through some hard times, some complicated times, but at the end of the day, I have you to myself. No family, no issues we can't work out. I can't imagine my life without you and your absolutely nutty family.
Fucking hell.
Rude.
I know, rude. So rude.
I hope to get over what they did. I wish I could get over it now because I see your pain from being away from them. I wish I could just fix this. I wish I could make all those issues and problems go away. But sometimes life is so complicated and there is no turning around. Sometimes the issue is bigger than us. And sometimes letting go is better than holding on.
Fucking hell.
Fuck, so manipulative. And another thing that he says during the letter is, making love to you is the nearest thing to a religious experience I've ever had. Oh, I want to die in your arms.
Wow.
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 All right, Byron. Fucking hell.
Yeah, that's textbook Byron.
Yeah, through and through. So obviously, this is just getting like wildly out of control, but luckily Debbie does reach her breaking point, and that comes from the way that John is treating Jacqueline, which is kind of full circle, because it's a lot easier to stand up
when it's not for yourself,
but for someone else. And I was speaking actually to someone about this, and I was saying, I think I'm so much more likely to see a red flag when someone is racist or sexist or talks about an issue in a way which I don't agree with, because I'm like, how dare you about this objective thing?
Mm.
But if it's about me, I will take that on and be like, maybe I'm not worthy or whatever.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what happened. And he is like threatening and abusing Jacqueline. He sends her pictures of her birth certificate with spit on it.
What the fuck?
He tells her to jump off a building head first. Like, just...
Wow, so like not being subtle at all.
Oh no, just full
this
on.
This man is not...
He's not a subtle bloke, is he?
No, but with his manipulation, like, that's really clever and smart and could be read as subtle. Yeah. But with this is just full on cunty.
Yeah, oh yeah. That is a well-deserved word in this scenario. And also, you know, she'd been planning to leave, so she had been hiding money from him and giving it away to people and things like that to make sure he wouldn't steal her money. And then he told her that he'd been tracking her bank accounts. And she was like, right, that's it. Nope, that and the
How
Jacqueline
do you even
thing
track a bank account?
Well, scary, right? Like, he had just got every little detail about her life. And so she said she wanted a divorce. She was in such a state, she grabbed only one shoe as she left the house.
Oh, honey.
And she left.
Oh, I want to give a cuddle.
I know.
Oh, God.
So sad.
Oh, I hate him.
Absolutely.
Also, you get out.
Yeah, you leave.
Why does Debs have to leave?
I paid for this place. Horrifying. And then he starts blackmailing her again with pictures.
Her business. She's fucking working and like has a family.
Totally. And he's just as he has done with all of them, he's making his victims look like his tormentors, right?
Oh.
Just twisting the story in the way which she like had been made feel so sorry for him before that. And she wanted to get an immediate restraining order for her and everyone in her family, actually, except for Tara, because she thought that Tara was safe. But really, no one is safe with a man like him around. But you need the following elements to get an immediate restraining order.
Yeah.
It has to be an emergency. You have to be fearing for your life, your safety imminently. And the perpetrator has to have means to harm you.
It's fucking wild.
So the court threw it out.
It's absolutely... Honestly, getting a restraining order is the biggest load of bollocks in the entire world.
Because he never physically hurt her.
But it's also like you've got a stalker.
Immediate danger.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you measure that, right?
Right.
That person could just decide to immediately turn around and stab you in the chest.
Oh, like, totally. Ridiculous. And because they didn't do anything about it, this is how bad things happen, because they don't intervene earlier.
And
this
like,
is the issue.
She's a perfect victim as well.
Perfect.
And that she still doesn't get it.
Yeah.
No.
So God knows what would have happened to someone that was not white, beautiful,
exactly,
and blonde.
Oh my God,
and
rich. Completely.
And rich and Christian.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And in LA.
Yeah.
Exactly. And she also, again, went and saw him to try and deal with things in person, which meant that they were like, because you have voluntarily gone and seen him, you will never get a restraining order from him now. So they, you know...
What is that dumb rule?
I know. It's
fucking dumb.
But it's protecting the wrong people, ultimately.
Yeah.
But when she went to visit him, he said he had cancer.
Oh, for God's
sake. Because he lost loads of
weight.
But more like he'd just been doing a shit ton of drugs. And June and July, at this point, passed 2 months and no one arrested him. They said they were just, quote unquote, collecting evidence. But he actually got caught on camera torching the inside of Deborah's car. So it really became apparent like how dangerous this man was. And everyone was really unwell, on edge at all times. Everyone was fraught. It's just a terrifying situation. And then one night, this is kind of when it all comes to a head, Jacqueline spots him and he's waiting for her by where she lives. But she's with one of her male friends and it kind of scares John off. And Deborah was like, I don't want to call the police, because she's lost faith in the police, because they won't give her a restraining order. She's like, it's just fine. Like, you know, he'll just go away eventually. But Jacqueline's really worried. She goes to check on Tara. But John, he didn't show again that night. But Tara, that day, had had a phone call from a voice she didn't recognise. And they said, we've met before, and I'm wondering if you'll be working at the dog grooming shelter tomorrow. And she was like, yeah, I will be. And he's like, great, I'll bring you my dog, blah, blah.
Fuck.
She didn't give it much thought, though. And she was working the next day, and this guy never showed. But once again, you know, relatively normal. She didn't give it much thought. But as she got home, she saw a man in the back of a car with a tire iron, and she thought it was just a homeless man. Once again, but it actually...
Sorry, with a tire iron?
A tire iron.
Like oh, a like a wrench? A wrench.
Yeah,
okay, yeah.
Yeah,
like a, yeah,
it's kind of like a metal rod that you use on a car.
Right, yeah.
I feel like I only know that from Cluedo. but it did turn out to be John. He'd removed the number plates from this rental car. He came out behind her and grabbed her by the waist. And he says, do you remember me? So she starts trying to escape, but he puts his hand over her mouth and she bites down on it really hard. And he's going for her. She thinks he's punching her. He's actually stabbing her.
Oh, fuck.
And her automatic reaction was to protect her chest. And so he stabbed her arms and he starts stabbing her bag, which actually is really quite amazing because she's protected her chest. She's done exactly the right thing. And so they're scrapping. They fall to the ground. And the whole time, Tara's dog is also attacking him. Like going for his ankles.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Okay, God bless that dog. They are too good for us. And the funny thing about this in the podcast is Tara says, she's like, I always had premonitions of death.
Oh, fuck.
Always hyper aware of TV murders. She was really into The Walking Dead, into Dexter. So when she's kicking him and he is trying to stab her and she's just kicking his arms away, she kicks the knife. It flies from her hand and the handle lands towards her. So she just goes straight into that Walking Dead mode, grabs it, stabs him in the back. She says it's like a life or death situation. She's stabbing him several times in the back and the arms, but he's still going for her.
Oh my God.
So eventually she stabs him through the left eye and into his brain.
Oh my fuck. God.
And she describes it as the zombie kill. Just kill or be killed. And inside his car, there was a kidnapping kit. He even had a fake passport to flee after. And so she's obviously just like horrified as this happens. She pushes him off of her. She's like completely
covered in blood.
Covered in blood.
In a daze.
So, yeah. A really young girl comes up to her and is like, are you okay? Tara's all over the place.
Oh my
she
God.
Grabs her phone, runs away, calls her mum and says, I think I killed your husband.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Really, really terrifying. I know, goosebumps all over. Just horrifying and just so traumatic for her as well, because she's so out of character. She's such a sweet, gentle
human. And she
was
the one that trusted him and gave him the benefit of the doubt as
and
well.
She was the only one that her mum thought didn't need a restraining order against him.
Fucking hell.
So when the paramedics arrive, he wasn't breathing, but he got CPR and he started breathing again. So he's like a literal zombie.
Oh my God.
They did it because they wanted to potentially use his organs, but he was a drug addict, so there was no hope of using that.
Right.
But he did go to the hospital, and at 57 years of age, he died in the hospital. And so, obviously, just, like, terrifying and tragic and so horrifying that it even was able to get that far. But afterwards, Debbie went to his residence where he was living, and she found a list of over 200 women and their phone numbers, some of them listed by anatomical parts.
What the fuck?
Because he was blackmailing them by pictures and things like that.
Oh my God.
She went on and found out that on the day they got married, he'd been on 3 dating website messaging all these women. It's kind of so tragic because this is the moment in which you really just empathize with Deborah so much, because she's like, was it real? Was it not real? She watches their wedding video and she says, doesn't he look happy? The trauma is clearly so hard for her to process.
Oh,
so even despite having done all of those horrendous things, she did love him. And that's kind of undeniable and amazing how those two things can be true at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, terrified of someone and love them. But I guess what's so incredible about it is, like, at the end of the TV series, you see her calling Chris Cofford at the LA Times and saying, you know, I know you've heard about my story and maybe we can tell it so that we can stop this happening to other women and highlight things to look out for, which is so brave and incredibly admirable, because it's embarrassing and traumatic and in no way like worth it. You know, a Netflix series is not worth all of that trauma, definitely not. And I actually really applaud her because it doesn't paint her in the best light. You know, it shows how flawed we all are and how we all fall victim to our ideals of love. And it's pretty brave that she did that. But yeah,
and after something like that, it'd be so easy for you to just turn away from everything and everyone and not want to show your face ever again and not want to trust anyone ever again.
Yeah, the shame could eat you alive.
Yeah, and also the fallout of that kind of thing in a family. I mean, what happened to her sister already, and then that happening, and the guilt that she would feel.
Yeah, huge.
That her daughter was nearly killed at the hands of her husband. Like, I just can't even imagine. You have to live with that for the rest. Everyone involved has to live with that for the rest of their lives.
And
terror. Because she's killed a man.
Him.
Because of him.
But that is the story of Dirty John.
Oh my God.
And not just a fuckboy, like, the ultimate, like, just dreadful. Evil person.
Murdering psychopath.
Yeah.
Monster.
But red flags.
Oh, but also human being, which human is being. The most terrifying part of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, Hannah.
Fuck, well done. That was amazing.
Oh, thank you. That was such a good job. I cannot believe that.
Thank you.
And you told it with such
pizzazz.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And
well, I hope it
understanding and empathy.
Yeah. I think there's obviously so much more nuance, and I cannot more highly recommend the TV show and the podcast. Yeah.
What does the TV show do with him? Like, is he really charming?
I think Eric Bana plays
him. Is he like kind of Dan Humphries in You?
Oh, no, because you really see the dark side of him. And I think as well, like, you don't empathize with him, which I think is important because, it explains why he is the way he is, but it does not justify his behavior. As I think so often, you know, like with James Bond, like he's got such a troubled life because of his hard upbringing and blah, blah. We make all these excuses for these dreadful blokes who do horrendous things.
Yeah.
And it's so important to not, like, in no way is that okay, and we cannot justify it. And he needed help. He was a sick man. He was unwell.
And, like, how disappointing he went through the prison system, and it's not a rehabilitation even slightly. No. That's just not the way that it's set up.
No.
And it, like, just breeds reoffence and breeds, like, more cruelty and more.
Also, how much of that is nature and how much of that is nurture?
Yeah, I think I have a feeling, you know, some people are born bad, unfortunately. You know, maybe even chemical imbalance.
Stuff like, but head traumas.
Oh, yeah, but
like,
he didn't have any of that.
Stuff like that.
And that's why.
Interesting.
Yeah, but, you know, they say that in the are born with psychopathic tendencies.
Yeah. And become just CEOs.
Were people horrified? Were they like, Eric Banner's hot?
I don't know. Well, that's the thing, isn't it? Women are... people love to victim shame. And I'm sure there was so much of that. But I do not victim shame her. I think she was, I think it could happen to most people. And, you know, she is the victim in this situation. Well, the survivor in this situation.
Yes.
The whole family is. But I think it is also that thing of, like, women being obsessed with true crime because we want to be prepared.
Totally.
Right? In the same way as Terror. Yeah. That's why we should all watch The Walking Dead and these, like, murder documentaries.
To My Favourite Murder.
Is a huge inspiration for us on this podcast.
Yeah.
And actually, I guess that's probably a good way for us to...
Segue.
We are all huge fans of My Favourite Murder. And we wanted, because we're not going to do murder very often on this podcast, we thought we'd take inspiration from how they do... fucking hoorays.
So I have a really heartwarming story about a man who moved to the area that I was living in during the pandemic. It was where I grew up in Wimbledon, and he was a homeless man, and he was living on the streets in Wimbledon. And I started talking to him, and I would often see lots of the community in Wimbledon talking to him, the locals talking to him. And we even stopped and had a chat with him, I remember.
Yeah, the three of us when we went for a walk in Wimbledon.
And he was such a great guy. And I would always go and get the newspaper on a Sundays, and then I would bring him a cup of coffee and like a croissant or something for breakfast in the morning. But he would always just be inundated with like bags of food from the community in Wimbledon.
But when we saw him, someone was like bringing him a really yummy looking mozzarella panini.
Mm. Yeah.
I'm thinking there's some mozzarella, tomato and pesto. Fantastic.
People would like Deliveroo him food to his little spot underneath the arches in Wimbledon. And so he was on the streets for a good few months, maybe I would say half a year. He didn't start off in Wimbledon.
No.
But he lost his housing due to the pandemic, and he lost his job due to the pandemic, and that's what got him on the streets. But every time I spoke to him, he had the kindest heart. He was incredibly smart, just such a wonderful man. And his name was Robert. He eventually got housing with the help of the community in Wimbledon, who like really backed him and found that for him. So one day he just wasn't there anymore. But in place was a letter stuck to the wall from him. And this is the letter. A message from Robert. I arrived here in the village seeking safety from the horrors of Wimbledon Broadway. Though sadly there was to be no immediate escape from the indifference of our wonderful local council. For the next 3 months, you good people inundated me not only with endless kindness and generosity, but also your friendship, in a manner I'd never encountered on the streets before. Being homeless is no fun at all, but collectively you made it bearable, if such a situation should ever have to be borne by anyone. And of all the dangers one has to face on the streets, loneliness and depression are by far the most destructive. Your efforts averted them to the point where it was, in many ways, an enjoyable experience. Throughout that time, a stream of outreach workers from Thames Reach, the result of your numerous calls, 49 in total, to StreetLink, never stopped hammering away at Merton Council, but I also have absolutely no doubt that many of you made representations to the council on my behalf. Eventually that pressure paid off. Within a further month, I was suitably housed on the King's Road, Chelsea. Such a spectacular result was finally brought about in no small measure by the tireless efforts of one energetic council officer, Geoffrey George.
Yes, Geoffrey.
Yes, Geoffrey. Thank you, Geoffrey. A man full of enthusiasm and purpose. A man whose job is also his vocation. So, the nightmare is now over, and I can resume my former life, a process that is already underway. The CV has been polished, job applications are in hand, debt resolution is underway, and my former social circle is being reactivated.
Oh.
I fully expect to be off the welfare bill within 2 or 3 months. A hero of mine once said, I shall return, and I can't think of no finer community within which to reside than yours. And so that has become my next goal, to return here to live among you before Christmas. May you all live long and prosper. Robert.
Oh my gosh. It's so beautiful.
He's such a lovely man.
Such a lovely man.
Thanks for reading that.
Thank you, Aniko.
Thank you, guys. Thank you, Robert.
If you were affected by this story, we have resources on our website, fboypodcast.com, which also lists brilliant charities for women, which, if you enjoyed this episode, we would encourage you to donate to.
And if you're inspired by Robert's story and you want to donate to homeless people across the UK, then please visit crisis.org.uk. They provide vital help so people can rebuild their lives and are supported out of homelessness for good.
That will also be in the show notes. And next week, we're going from the crooks of Cali to the spiritual fuckboys of Siberia. Well, fuckboy.
Yes.
The main fuckboy of Siberia.
Cue stormy weather music. Where we delve into mystical mischief of Rara Rasputin.
In the meantime, you can help us by rating us and following the F-Boy podcast wherever you're listening.
You can find even more fuckboyery on Instagram and Twitter at F-Boy Podcast.
Or at fboypodcast.com, where you can send us your very own fuckboy stories.
Special thanks to our brilliant producers at Audio Boom.
So, watch out, lover of the Russian Queen.
We're coming for you.